Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures into everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. Hi, Gail. It's been a while. You've been traveling. We've had some issues, but we're back in the saddle, huh?
We are so happy to be back. How you doing?
I'm doing great. So I'm really excited about today. So let's get rolling. All right.
Indeed.
We live in an era where dinner conversations are often dominated by some of the darkest corners of the human psyche, as society remains endlessly gripped by the why behind the world's most chilling true crime cases. Producer Jack Cole joins us today to help us decode this obsession. He's an executive producer, documentary filmmaker, and writer behind some of your favorite reality and true crime series, including Suddenly Amish, now streaming on HBO Max, where he was executive producer, and a series on Prime called The Curious Case Of. So when he isn't busy developing his new slate of major media projects or getting his hands dirty with his DIY home construction in Reading, Connecticut, Jack's a true student of the craft, an avid reader, and a foreign film buff. So please welcome with us today, Jack Cole. Jack, it's great to have you with us.
We are so excited to have you, Jack. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks, Tom. Thanks, Gail. I appreciate being on. I appreciate the invitation. I'm looking forward to this conversation. I have a lot of thoughts about all this.
Well, let me kick it off with a philosophical question, and we'll get into some of the mechanics as we go along.
Really philosophical. When you talked about, you know, some of the, you know, darkest corners of human psyche, I thought you were talking about, you know, the four corners of my brain.
Mine as well. Anybody that's spent a life in court like we have, you have that part of your brain intact.
Right?
Jack, you spent a lot of time in your career with that sort of intersection between reality and entertainment. The question I want to start off with is, why do you think as a culture we're uniquely at home with stories of other people's tragedy, and we have this need to watch other people's lives unfold?
Well, that's a big question, and it's one that I think about all the time. You know, in order to understand and do the work that I do, it's important that I really understand that in each individual I work with, you know, understand what drives them. As far as the viewer, as far as the people that tune in and want to understand, first of all, like, storytelling is like, you know, one of the very earliest sort of, as long as we've had verbal language, or even before that, you know, cave drawings or whatever. It's storytelling is an essential piece of what makes us human. So that's what's obviously, you know, clearly going to draw anyone into that. And, you know, you folks as judges and lawyers understand that clearly. The story is the most important part. You know, as far as why people tune in, my theory, pardon me if I run on here at all, because I love to talk, and I love to hear myself talk.
Go right ahead.
Oh, you would be a great judge.
I know. Well, there you go. Maybe I will. I typically do judge, but it's not professionally. So basically my thought is, it's really hard at a certain age, especially as we get older, we have even tougher times, especially if we ever came up in a situation where feeling, you know, in America, feelings and emotions, and in modern culture, like, it's not sexy to have to really be in touch with your feelings. I could say maybe that's a generalization for, you know, men from a certain perspective, but I think in general it's hard to deal with your feelings, and people don't want to do that. And so it's always a lot easier. But people still have this, like, innate desire and this human need to be in touch with their feelings. So why not watch somebody on TV going through them, right? You know, think about how cathartic it feels when you watch a great performance by a great actor or actress,
right?
And you feel that the goosebumps on your arms, or you hear a song, you know, you someone has done this performance and the song hits a certain, you know, note change, chord progression, and all of a sudden, like, your arms just pop out with goosebumps in this sort of, I think, what's referred to as frisson in that situation. And so, you know, I think people, when we say we want to be entertained, we just want to really feel something. You know, we want to be able to feel those things that maybe we don't feel comfortable actually going into the depths of our heart and trying to pull out. We want to just say, hey, I'm safe. I'm safe back here behind the screen. You know, no one's going to make me cry. No one's going to make me, you know, no one's going to yell at me. But man, I kind of want to feel that inside of me, because that is what makes us human.
If I can follow up, Gail, real quick, and then I'll let you take off.
Because, you know,
here,
I'm like at the edge of my seat, like, wow, that sounds compelling.
I know you are. When I watch reality television, everything from Real Housewives to the true crime, you know,
Tom, tell me you have not been watching Real Housewives.
Oh, I have in the past, but I've been forced to. But my point was that part of me tries to identify with the person either going through trauma or whatever they're going through. And the other part of me gets sort of a self-satisfying feeling, thank God that's not me. And so I end up at the end feeling better than when I began. Is that an odd reaction?
No. And I mean, that feels like a pretty common reaction. You know, I must say, I am not a psychologist. I am not a trained, you know, in the psychological professions at all. Although I am a bit of an armchair psychologist, but I would say that makes sense. I mean, I don't know if I'd say all television or film, but definitely reality, escapism is a huge part of that. The ability to just, you know, turn your brain off for a little while and just live in this person's world. And, you know, I don't think that's odd. I mean, I think it makes sense. I mean, these people are, you know, there's a certain amount of direction and editing and the ability to, you know, casting, especially getting people that are comfortable putting themselves out there in all ways. Mm-hmm. And so that makes sense. You know, I there's a lot more I could say on that, but it makes sense that you, and I think it's okay. I mean, I don't know what that really draws into question as far as when we see some, it's really the head rolling down the highway phenomenon.
But I also think there's a lot of, you know, adjacency and empathy that is built out of these experiences too. Would you agree that, you know, for every time you reflect something that is at least billed as reality, because I think to some degree, at least there's some part of society that has, you know, a little bit of skepticism that says, you know, some of this is just entertainment. But there's I think a great deal of society that says, no, this is actually real. And they kind of see themselves as, you know, adjacent to it, or that it reflects a certain part of their own lived experience that maybe they are not prepared to face, accept, or deal with, but kind of, you know, maybe deal with vicariously through someone else. Would you say that that's maybe part of it as well, that kind of lends to the culture of society right now and why it's so acceptable, why it's so popular, why so many people are bought into it?
I have no idea. I have zero empathy, so I couldn't answer that question. No, no.
I love it. Okay.
No, you can't have empathy. You can't have empathy and be a reality TV.
You should
producer.
Sit on the bench, Jack.
I just said he should be a judge, and yeah, he just underscores why he should.
I have to recuse myself from any of their emotions. No, listen, Gail, I think you're right on the money. Yeah, I think the vicariousness makes sense. You know, I like to always say, because yeah, there is that skepticism about reality TV, and every barbecue I go to, any time I go anywhere where someone says, oh my God, you're a reality TV producer, I want to know more about that. The one point I can always stick with, which is crazy and will shock a lot of people, maybe not yourself, Gail, as you've been involved in our world of reality TV. And for those who don't know, I worked with Gail for a while in developing some judge TV shows, but also we did work on Court Night Live, where for A&E, which she knocked completely out of the park.
She did.
Absolutely a superstar, complete superstar. But, but Gail, to that
jury's
point,
still out on that.
Hey, who knows? I mean, bring it back. But, the one thing I will say to that, though, is that ultimately reality TV is more real than not, right? There are circumstances that are arranged, this just for the ease or ability to catch some of these moments. Hey, we're going to go meet over there. Like things that may not have just straight up happened in someone's, I don't think I'm telling any secrets here. Everyone knows that's the way that these shows, sort of get done efficiently. But the reality of it all is we don't make these people any different than they are. And Suddenly Amish is a great example, right? This is the kind of show where you see skeptics all over the place. The reality is, like, you'd have to find the greatest actor of all time to portray an Amish person. But these people are their culture. You cannot shake it out of them. And this is what it is. So you can't fake that. And then anyone who's willing to go in and try to become Amish, from the English side, as we say it, or the not Amish side, I mean, those folks, they have their reasons to be why they're there, And so that's the same with every other project I've ever been on, is these people are, what you find there is so much closer to the truth. It's 99% on the truth. The 1% is just like, it's just built in stuff for efficiency. It has nothing to do with like, we're going to change your story to this or that. I don't know if that answers your question.
It actually does. And Tom, I'm going to let you in here in just a second. It actually raises kind of a different query for me. And I suspect Tom's probably, leading down this road too, which kind of caused on the ethical side of things. And to me, I was thinking the whole while about, okay, well, what about, kind of the ethics of the edit, right? And that's kind of speaks to what you were talking about, Jack, is that, you kind of take your folks as you find them. And what you're presenting is not anybody different than who was always there in the first place. But what we see is legitimately the folks that you bring. But for the purpose of efficiency, some of it just has to be edited. For the purpose of our audience, what we really try to do is we are, trying to present to them, and we work really hard to present to them, this entire legal landscape in a way that makes sense. The jargon.
Especially now.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That makes sense to them so that they can navigate the system and the process and that it makes sense. And so in taking into consideration what you do and presenting, whether it's, subtly Amish or even the curious case of, you're often dealing with these complex structures and even complex people. Mm-hmm. And you have to deal with these complex situations that no doubt have to be edited in some way or another. Sure. And I'm wondering, how do you do that ethically without changing the construct of it in a way that can really kind of change even the texture of what you're presenting in this efficient way you're trying to do it? So how do you handle the presentation of it without affecting the ethics?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, my understanding, and again, like, I know civics in America in 2026 are a sort of a lost art, I guess, and who knows any number of things that are to blame for that at this point. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different answers to that question. There's great philosophers and great filmmakers over the decades who have spoken to the nature of reality, the nature of the moment you put something on camera versus when it hits the edit. Just from a, sort of behind the curtain perspective, ultimately when people sign up for the project, they sign away, aside for any of these projects, any of these reality shows, they sign away a lot of their ability to sort of have any control over the narrative or the creative side of things.
Oh yeah. Autonomy's gone. And so,
right.
Yeah, the idea of you having control over this is gone once you finish that signature. I mean, I guess my question is, how do you make sure you still, you know, keep the hook, you know, while balancing the, you know, not the exploitation or the malicious intent, but just making sure, okay, the edit isn't going to kind of get in the way of that.
Jump on me if I'm not, if I'm sort of going outside of the bounds of the understanding of ethics, but, you know, for starters, there's always a couple things that keep us in check, you know, mm-hmm. keep the boundaries of the story. First and foremost, there's not a television channel or production company out there that wants to get sued. So like you got to
unless you're Colbert, I guess, or Jimmy.
I mean, right. Well,
nobody wants to be sued. Nobody.
Right.
Nobody.
Right.
They don't even want to be sued. They just want to tell jokes. That's all right. They want.
Right. Well, and that brings in, you know, a whole other sort of, you know, idea about like, what is the nature of the lawsuit and, you know, litigation at this point. But
and did they really mean that First Amendment thing?
Right. Right. And so, but to that point, you know, TV networks and production companies are not trying to jump over the bounds of like, libel, slander, you know, some of these things, you know, making accusations about, especially with the true crime stuff, like you just have to be extremely careful. I mean, you can change the detail on one thing or another, but it can't, you know, it cannot, I guess I would say the word is like materially affect someone's safety. I mean, it does come down a lot to the First Amendment. It does come down a lot to shouting fire in a movie theater. It's an existential question about the idea of telling a story in language. And ultimately, you know, it's the one thing I coach a lot of my people on, the people that I direct and the people I work with in these shows, I always tell them, because their first question is always, man, like how is it going to be the case like that you can't make me look like this, that, or the other? Like, you know, how do I know that you're not going to just make me blank? And I always say the one way you get around that, the one way that you can sort of assure that in a world where you can't actually assure that because you've signed away your rights, the one way you can assure it is just be real. You know, if you're owning your story, if you're owning your truth, if you're owning your reality, there's very little that can happen to you in edit. You know, edit really only has to, you know, I would say the only time the edit even gets close to skirting any ethical lines only comes at a time when somebody, when the story has broken down in one place or another. And it really just comes down to like, I don't even say convenience sake, but it's just, hey, we have to connect this piece to the other piece. And the only way we can do that is with editing. And again, in that space and in that time and place, we're aiming to make sure that we're not getting sued. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. you know, we have to be very careful about when we do make those shortcuts, so to speak, that we're not doing anything that's going to ruin someone's life. You know, and again, these things can, there's always a gray area with this kind of stuff, right? Because it's like, what I might feel will ruin my life, maybe you're not going to feel is going to, you know, ruin your life.
Let me ask a different question. And that is going back to your initial thoughts on storytelling. When you did Suddenly Amish and also the Curious Case of series, you bring the viewer into a world that they may not understand. The legal system's full of legalese. The Amish system full of cultural norms and cultural rules that the outsider doesn't understand. So how do you bring the viewer along with the how do you bring them into that world without sounding, you know, textbookish and mm-hmm. but making mm-hmm. sure that they understand where they are?
Well, I mean, every show I've ever worked on, you know, our goal is to understand that the viewer is intelligent. You know, the viewer is showing up. We're not out there to try to offend them and you know, play them for dumb. I mean, and we also know that there's an attention span situation. You know, we want to keep you interested while teaching you these things. And so I would say, Tom, the goal there is to be very thrifty. I don't know if that's the right word here, but be very, less is more. And you wouldn't understand that. You wouldn't get that from as much as I talk. But we understand in edit that less is more. And so we try to describe something very complicated. And I'll tell you, that's the thing we wrestle with. I mean, Suddenly Amish was a hit. And the first episode, we had to describe a lot of stuff. And we had to tell a lot of different things about where someone came from and why these things are being done. And it was like, I think there was one moment, there was one point where we had, you know, two full, like 42 minute episodes, basically, where we were just trying to describe what was going on. It just takes some finesse. It takes some artistry. So that's where the real skill comes in, is being able to keep the viewer in the mix, you know, really keep them on the edge of their seat while also making sure not to insult their intelligence. That's, you know, that's what I was trying to say earlier, but you know, really, really have them come along for the ride, learn. A lot of people want to learn things, especially when if people have tuned in for the, I mean, the Amish are, you know, endlessly fascinating. Right. And that's the other thing I'm sure we're going to talk about crime, you know, even more here in the upcoming minutes, but that's why people tune into true crime, because behind the legalese, you can see a body back there.
Yeah. Which makes it real, even if you don't understand the legalese.
Correct. Correct.
So I noticed, though, on your list of people involved with the Curious Case Hub, that you have a person labeled legal analyst. Mm-hmm. Do you seek help in doing these translations?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Hot Snakes Media, who, you know, makes the Curious Case Hub and Suddenly Amish, but especially with Curious Case Hub, you know, on that production team. So the host is Beth Karras. She is, I'm going to get this wrong, but I think she was district attorney at some point. You know, they also have a very strong FBI, you know, former FBI agent on their production team as well. Actually, Shannon Evangelista, who is one of the owners and founders of Hot Snakes Media, she herself was, I think she was an assistant district attorney, maybe even New York City. I mean, she was like a pretty legit, super smart, super creative, also understands the legal system back and front.
Now, that actually begs another question, because Tom and I both know that breaking down legal jargon can often feel like, you know, interpreting Latin or decoding Latin.
There may even actually be some Latin in there, I'm guessing.
Yes.
Gail's our Latin expert.
he calls me our resident Latin expert.
Okay,
that's right.
And it's not always easy, and it's sometimes, you know, just quite frankly, it can be very challenging, and it can be pretty difficult for television. Like the translation can be, I mean, there's one thing that happens in a courtroom, but to make that translate to television can be a bit of a leap. So how do you make that, how do you create that bridge so that it remains interesting? How do you, and while you're creating that, the planks in that bridge, how do you maintain the integrity mm-hmm. of the case, making sure that it doesn't get overly complicated, mm-hmm. but it still is something that the viewer can digest and understand while they are still ingesting this scene or this case? Because again, the law isn't always easy. In fact, it's often very, very complicated for the average person. You know, the courtroom is the last place they ever want to be. And in large part, because they just don't get it. They just don't understand it. And so how do you decode that?
translate all these legal procedures into something that's understandable in a very short period of time.
And entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, so Curious Case, for instance, is an hour long. You know, each episode's an hour long. So you've got a lot of time to really, I mean, that, you know, I would say what you're asking about is kind of the heart of these projects. You know, it's sort of think of the original sort of most famous true crime projects, you know, movies or I would say at this point it's, you know, The Jinx.
Oh, have you seen The Jinx, Tom?
Yes.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, you know, Serial on NPR, you know, that was, these are projects that, again, that's actually, you know, it's funny. True crime is kind of the thing that actually in some ways gives me a little bit of hope about our society. I know it's weird that like everyone wants to go, you know, watch stuff about death and murder or whatnot, but I would say the true crime projects, the things that interest me the most and the things that I find are the most important to build out is exactly what you're talking about. It's giving the opportunity, you know, it's kind of like here's a sort of funny analogy, right? But you know, some people watch Monday Night Football and they just want to get the play-by-play or whatever, you know, whereas Monday Night Football, you know, sometimes you'll watch the regular telecast. Some people like to watch, you know, nerds like me, football nerds like to watch, you know, like the Manning cast with the you know, Peyton and Eli, because it's like, hey, you know, it's kind of fun to see someone get wonky and break it down. And I think that's the same thing with the true crime stuff. Like, I think a huge draw of the true crime is not the grisly stuff necessarily, but it's the you know, the sci-fi almost that you get from sort of understanding and riding along with the courts, with the judges, with the lawyers as they make their cases. I mean, I know that when I was out in the field producing these shows, we left no stone unturned when interviewing the prosecutors, the attorneys. Yeah.
So you're suggesting it's the process. It is the process that A, gives you hope, but it's also the process that is what I guess inspires folks to really be interested and to want to know more. Is that what I'm hearing?
I think so. I think process is the thing. Yeah. I mean, it's the same reason people watch, you know, HGTV or Magnolia, something, you know, This Old House, you know, people do like the process. It makes you, you know, honestly, I would say what it does is we're looking at a true crime, right? We're looking at a grisly murder, or we're looking at someone treating someone else unfairly, or we're seeing, you know, scams and cons and all these things. And the process kind of makes you feel a little bit better. You know, it's kind of like, hey, this chaotic craziness is going on in this project, in this show, in this crime. But there is a process out there. There is a little something that puts this thing into control, that takes this wildness, this craziness, this stuff, and says, hey, hold on. You had some good lawyers here, right? Like, let's not start freaking out and pulling our hair out. It's going to be okay. There might be a mystery at the end, but there's going to be kind of a happy ending of like, hey, we at least have some thoughts. We have some ideas of how this is going to go. Not to be insensitive, but I mean, I'd really like to, you know, I like the stories where they do have happy endings, and, you know, not to bring up something out of left field that maybe you guys have also dealt with a little bit on the show. I don't even know, but like Savannah Guthrie's mom, yeah. You know, like, not to get too like, you know, morbid on this, but that case freaks everybody out right now. I don't even actually know where it is at this point, but like it has us on the edge of our seats. And we don't know. I mean, talk about true crime, you know, and that's going to be made into 10 different true crime documentaries. But wouldn't it be nice to have some theories at this point, you know, that we could go in and watch an hour long episode about, you know, her mom and say, okay, like, you know, even if the theories end up being like misdeeds by officers or people in charge, I mean, you know, these things happen, that's real. But I think the process in these projects and in these shows helps to put the universe into a little bit of a structure.
The Murdaugh case in South Carolina was exceedingly popular, both the actual case and the documentaries that came out after that. That seemed to have all of the elements. It had family, it had murder, it had drugs, it had almost everything.
It had theft. Remember, there were multiple Murdaugh cases. Remember, it wasn't
There's civil, the one. The theft. Yeah.
And then it was preceded by the murder of the housekeeper. It started with the murder of the housekeeper and the theft of the insurance money.
The death of the housekeeper. Nobody's been convicted of murder yet. The death
That's
of the
right, yet. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And my point was that that case was a natural for documentaries and real true crime as it's happening kind of approach. How about the cases that you look at that aren't as obvious? How do they come to you or your staff? How much is you searching for them? How much actually comes through the door to you?
Sure. Well, and again, I need to sort of pass off, you know, I mean, I've developed any number of different projects at this point. You know, as far as the Curious Case of an incredible team, you know, diving in on that project, you know, when I was working on Suddenly Amish, people were already working on the Curious Case of. So I can't take any credit for diving in on the cases, but from what I know in the stuff I've done and from what I know with that show, it's not the story of a good crime.
Yeah, I guess you do wonder like what makes quote unquote a good crime, especially Tom, given how many crimes we've seen and in
absolutely.
It's
various
it's just,
forms.
It's mystery. It's mystery. It, what it comes down to is it's you know, we're talking about the Sherlock Holmes sort of genre here. You know, mystery is people, again, like people like to tune in and feel that vicarious sadness or excitement or that spontaneous laughter, you know, that you just really reminds us that we're human. I think mystery is part of that as well, right? You know, just like, and to go sort of back into psychology, but peekaboo or the Jack in the Box. Mm-hmm. The Jack in the Box, which I actually invented as Jack. dad joke. But no, I will say there is something about being surprised that provides you with this really exciting feeling. And so that can be found. It doesn't have to be found just in murder and double dealing. And the way the true crime shows and the genre work the best is to lay it out like a mystery, to lay out, you know, red herrings, misdirections. And that can be done with, I did a show not long ago, maybe in the last 5 years or so, with called History's Greatest Mysteries, hosted by Lawrence Fishburne. And I did an episode on the Holy Grail. You know, the Holy Grail's never been found. It probably doesn't exist. But, you know, you can craft a really thrilling and exciting mystery, especially based on the number of theories that have come out at this point. You know, we had five acts in that episode. And, you know, we had a theory for every act. And that's the same kind of thing with true crime is, you know, we can, even if these things were, you know, using our artistry and skills, you know, even if something is a theory that got shot down, you know, the next day, you can still lean into it as a potential exciting, you know, idea. Again, the one thing keeping you from, you know, going too crazy on these things is you just don't want to accuse someone of something that they didn't do. You know, or really even insinuate at this point. But again, you guys know the ideas of slander and libel, you know, better than I do.
You talked about putting out red herrings and having people maybe misdirected a little bit to hype the mystery of the story. Are these things that you develop? You develop the red herrings, or they're red herrings in any case, and you follow those leads till they drop off?
No, they're in the case.
Okay.
You know, the question is whether or not they are a huge deal. But I mean, I think about it, like when you're a young prosecutor, you know, getting down to your case and you're saying this could happen, but that could happen. But what about this thing? You know, you're sort of going through and hitting all those story points. We're not going to make our case on this thing because it doesn't land and it doesn't. You know, and so meanwhile, you know, that's kind of the same thing that's happening. We would love to, you know, we would love to say, could it be the, you know, Colonel Mustard with the candlestick in the parlor? Yeah. But we really have nothing to like even get remotely close to putting that out there. So like, unless it has some very sexy cachet of like, whoa, like, you know, you could potentially tie, you know, Kim Kardashian into this crime, like, you know, you know, and you could never blame her for something. You could maybe say, oh, this guy had real interest in Kim Kardashian. Now, granted, you know, the prosecution decided to not even go with that idea for the most part, because it's like, and I'm just making this up completely out of left field, but like, you know, the prosecutor decided not to go with that because it did absolutely nothing for the case. But I mean, in the TV show, it's like, well, you thought of it. And it's got this A-list, you know, A-lister name recognition. You know, is there something? Could we use it for 3 seconds, or we sort of get out of an act? And is it not going to hurt anybody? You know, I mean, that's kind of the idea too.
As a defense attorney, I threw out red herrings. I made a living throwing out red herrings.
Sure. So
totally understand what you're talking about.
Those were your shaded suits throughout trial.
That's right.
I got to see these suits.
Well, no, the theory is you wear a dark suit on the first day of trial to show the seriousness of the matter. And each day the trial goes on, your suit gets lighter and lighter until the end of the case, where people then, the jury identifies that the shadow of guilt has been removed from this poor innocent person.
Oh my gosh. You have to do an episode on these tricks. I hope you have already, because I mean,
no,
forget what I'm talking about. Yeah.
It is clearly captured in prior episodes, as are a lot of our behind the scenes.
I need to go listen. I'm bad. I'm a bad friend.
The prosecutor versus, that's what makes us, you know, such an interesting pair here, because as the former defense attorney, former prosecutor, both of us former judges, we have very different vantage points that we bring here. But it's really interesting, the vantage point that you bring, because what you bring is our work alive in a very different way, from a very different perspective, which is why I am so enamored by what you do, because Tom and I never really imagined, or we never envisioned, the work that we do in a courtroom being seen through the lens that you see it through cinematically. And so we never, and Tom, correct me if I'm wrong, but when we're handling cases, I never imagine a case kind of being interpreted through a cinematic lens. I'm just there kind of marching through it.
And most cases are boring. Let's be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most and you can't imagine somebody putting a twist on it that makes it interesting.
Yeah, right. I'm sitting there on the bench going, please, God, please, give me something interesting here.
Well, you know, your interesting is, I'm keeping it in my pants, right? The guy that yells.
That's good TV.
No, I had a guy that yelled that to me. I had sentenced him to a weekend in jail for indecent exposure. And so I went off to the Supreme Court and did a fellowship at the U.S. Supreme Court and came back and was in practice. And I was walking clients down to the court, and this guy saw me from across the street and yelled, "Judge, I'm keeping it in my pants. I'm keeping it in my pants." So that's the reference.
he clearly hadn't recognized him. He recognized him as a judge who he was now a defense attorney, but he was abiding by the court's rules and the court's order even still. And
even that still, that was a success story.
I mean, listen, you know, peekaboo, Jack in the Box. We're talking, you know, these are, you know, guy takes it out of his pants. Hey, you're a first grader. Let's put it away. Come on, bud.
Yeah. You know, and he was still concerned about potentially violating a court order. And so he wanted the judge to know.
He wanted to let me know. And he did.
That court order stuck.
Yeah. He was diligent. That's great.
You have done several shows regarding the Amish. How did you get onto that topic, and how did you gain the trust of people who are generally distrustful of media to allow you to do this?
Well, that's the job. That's sort of the skill is, I'm the kind of person who can, you know, talk to a wall. I'm sure Judge Gail would agree with that. Oftentimes when Gail and I are talking, she gets like three words in and I just don't shut up. You know, with the Amish in particular, again, this was a project that at the time, my bosses and the founders of the company, Hot Snakes Media, Eric and Shannon Evangelista, they had made the first forays in by, you know, the Amish. There's a lot of ex-Amish, you know, and there's a lot of ex-Mennonites.
Right.
And they tend to sort of still live near the community, right? Because they can't quite escape that insular world that they came out of. And so they're still, you know, on the outskirts. And so, you know, that was simple as that. The Evangelistas formed a relationship with a few different, ex-Amish folks. And then those people brought them, into the actual Amish folks. So that's how that was sort of the practical piece of it, was getting the quote unquote fixers from the outside. And then once you got inside, you just had to, you know, I'm a student of, again, sort of armchair psychology and history and culture and society and sociology and anthropology and all these things. I see myself as a pretty curious person. It's funny. I also am a chameleon in the sense that, you know, my dad's a Jewish guy from Chicago. My mom is a, country, Christian woman from New Hampshire. I grew up in Austin, Texas. You know, I spent a year and a half on a Navajo reservation, New Mexico, when I was a small child, as my dad was working in technology there. It's all to say that I was raised around a multiplicity of different cultures. And so going and being around the Amish, you know, the first and foremost, you like anything, you just need to come in with respect, curiosity. You can't come in with an assumption that you know who these people are. You know, you have to be humble and have humility and understand that everyone has a story to tell and everyone has a story they live. And so, yeah, the goal is just to go in and say, I don't know everything. Please tell me about yourself. And that builds a relationship very quickly.
And I think the humble curiosity serves you well. In continuing that thread, I thought about that when you think about the curious case of. And when you think about that, I wonder these people have cases and these same cases as Tom was talking about, you know, we got transcripts. I mean, you know, courts of record, you could always get the transcript. You could read them. They're boring, but you can read them. How do you get people to tell their stories of their experiences in court? And without just relying on a transcript, how do you get them to tell their own story?
You know, it's always a healthy bargaining chip where you can say, hey, those things are out there. We're going to be able to tell your story, whether it involves you or not, because it is in the transcript. It is in the court. It's in public, you know, it's in the public record. And that at that point is not, it's not a threat. I mean, it's literally just, hey, like we have, like, the story is going to be told. Would you be interested in being the person that gets to own it from this point forward, you know, and in this project? And a lot of people will say, yeah. You know, a lot of people, you know, some people say, I can't do it again. You know, go ahead and tell the story, you know, but they, and some people say, I thought this thing was going to die. I thought it was going to go away years ago. The reality is it's, as you said, Gail, it's there. The story's out there and we're not telling any part of the story that isn't already out there in vast piles of evidence and court record.
The Amish series that you did was probably, in my view, more reality television. Some of the true crime things that you do, I'm curious of whether you see those as reality television or documentaries.
Well, I don't put a whole lot of space between documentary and reality, just because, you know, the Jinx is a great example, right? I don't know if you know the controversy with the Jinx, but
yes.
Right, there's question about whether or not the thing that was said by Robert Durst in the bathroom at the end, you know, kill them all, I killed them all, or whatever the actual quote was, you know, there's question about whether or not that was actually taken in the ethical and appropriate way, or if it was used out of context. And that's a huge no-no. And that, you know, this is a long way of explaining it, but I did a show recently last year. I was a story producer for a show called SEC Any Given Saturday. It was a Netflix series done by Box to Box Films, an incredible sports programming group. They do this show about F1 they do. And you know, that is a documentary series. And the definition of it as a documentary series is because it's like, you know, how are they gonna make this about reality? But I will tell you that behind the scenes, how the sausage is made, my experience as a reality TV producer, which really comes down to just telling the story in an efficient, captivating way, that's ultimately where Box to Box and Netflix wanted to land even on that series. And so you could be confused into thinking or tricked into thinking like, oh man, there's no way this is reality TV because it's got all the camera, you know, they're not gonna make an athlete say this and, you know, whatever, you know, all the athletes all have to have all signed on for this. But the reality here is that my definition of reality TV is simply how the story is told. Less so, I don't hang on it these ideas of being unethical or being trickery or any of that stuff. In my mind, reality TV is simply documentary that is aiming to tell a story in an efficient, captivating way. You know, and most of these cases could have, you know, a 10-part series. The actuality of it is that there's something very satisfying about seeing it in an hour versus 10 hours. You know, that's a good evening. You know, you don't want to stay up all night. You just want to, you know, eat a chicken pot pie, lay down on your couch and watch this great episode of Curious Case after you go to sleep.
So captivating and entertaining are the same in your book.
Yeah, especially when it comes to true crime, because yeah, entertaining is one thing, but captivating to me is more essential than entertaining, because in the stories that I like to tell and that the people that I've worked with like to tell, captivating implies, against all odds at sometimes even, pulling you forward into the next act, leaving you in cliffhangers and really bringing you to the next stage. And for me, that's what any good, you know, whether it be Stranger Things or The Jinx or Curious Case of or Suddenly Amish, it's the ability to bring your viewer to the next stage, keep them enwrapped and teach them some stuff along the way as well.
Similar to what we try to do, Tom.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
To some degree. This true crime space that seems to become more and more crowded, because it seems like this is an area that you are not standing in alone. What do you see as next? And how do you see the role that the justice system plays in this? Because yeah, a lot of true crime clearly intersects with the justice system. So what's next? Is there space, and what's the role for the justice system where Tom and I are hailing from and hoping that will continue to educate folks along the way.
Well, I mean, what am I on trial here?
We're just hoping to be some do-gooders on our way out the door.
No, listen, I mean, do you want me to go into the sort of AI meets?
We hope not to be out of work.
No. I think the science fiction idea for a long time now. I'm sure some movie or TV show has done this at some point, but you know, the idea of like, when do people start committing crimes just to be able to get a good documentary together? Not to get too political, but by the nature of social media and by the nature of the folks who have the loudest voices these days, truth is not an essential piece of all that. And so, the question's going to be, who wants to continue to be the arbiter of truth, and what is truth exactly? Truthiness, I think that goes even further back, alternative facts. You can sort of go through all these things. You start to get into a very Orwellian space. There's a lot of great movies and books and things, The Running Man. There's things that have been written over the years that, Philip K. Dick, all of his science fiction stuff, inspirations for Total Recall and Blade Runner. RoboCop. Terminator. You have these things that tell of a world gone mad, which we're currently living in. We're at that place now, and so I guess to answer your question, Gail, I don't know. I don't know how the justice system handles the intersection of entertainment and the law. I think the justice system right now has a lot bigger questions to answer besides the entertainment side of things.
It is pretty fragile. I think Tom and I agree is that we've certainly seen a system that is being, at least in our view, being pushed to the point of severe fragility and
being broken.
we are concerned about its ability to withstand more pressure and more tests against its ability to withstand the pressure. And we remain hopeful because there are times when we think it is the only pillar of democracy that is withstanding such tests. And we're not, I don't know that I am convinced that it is as enduring as we'd hope it would be at a time like now, but we need it to be.
Jack, we're out of time, and we could talk forever on this topic and others. Thanks so much for talking with us and being with us today.
Boy, Jack, this was amazing. And thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation. And let's have another episode soon.
We'll do that. Hey, Gail, why don't you tell people how they can find us?
Oh, my gosh. We are so grateful to be back in action. And we look forward to you checking us out, first of all, with our primary support, that being NPR, National Public Radio. Please check us out anywhere you find your favorite podcasts. Again, that's NPR, that's Apple, Spotify, iTunes, Amazon, Audible. And again, anywhere you might find your favorite podcasts, we are Next Witness. Please. We genuinely believe that this system of law, democracy is so important because you don't trust what you don't understand. And our goal is that we improve your understanding. And by doing that, you'll trust us more.
If you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can email me directly at Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. That's Hodson@ohio.edu. Also, if you have topics you would like for us to cover in the future, please shoot me an email and we'll put your topic on our list. Next Witness Pleased is produced by WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron's our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back very soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.